All right, we're going to be picking up the study on page 429 of your outline. And we're at chapter 40, verse 1 of the book of Jeremiah. Now, where did we leave off last week? Last week, we saw the fall of the city of Jerusalem in 586. We saw all that Jeremiah went through. We especially looked at his imprisonment in that cistern and his rescue by Ebed-Melech, then the fall of Jerusalem, and then the chapter closed with this blessing to Ebed-Melech. Remember that? This Ethiopian Gentile who was excluded from temple worship because he was a eunuch, but not excluded from the family of God because he trusted God. And he was given this blessing. You will see the horrors of the fall of Jerusalem, but you will survive it. You will survive it. So why did God give him that blessing? Top of page 429, point B, point A, because you have put your trust in the Lord. Okay? He may be excluded from temple worship, but he was not excluded from salvation. Okay, so that brings us to point B, chapter 40, on page 429. We'll start look at the events after the fall of Jerusalem. And there's two main divisions of this section. Point one there is the events after the fall in Judah, chapter 40 through 43, or beginning of 43. And then starting in chapter 43, 8 through 44, we'll look at the events after the fall in Egypt. So we won't get quite through chapter 43. We'll get up to chapter 43. At least we did this morning class. We'll do our best there to get up to there. All right. So let's begin with the release of Jeremiah, where the occasion is chapter 40, verse 1. Is everybody there on the correct page? Okay. Chapter 40, verse 1. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, captain of the bodyguard, had released him from Ramah, when he had taken him bound in chains among all the exiles of Jerusalem and Judah who were being exiled to Babylon. All right, you ought to be saying, wait a second, Bob, what's going on here? Last week he was released from Jerusalem by Nebuzaradan. Now you say he's being released from Ramah. You know, is this contradictory? I'm sure a critic of Scripture would say, see, Jeremiah doesn't know what he's doing. See, these contradictory accounts. Well, a little harmonization will make this quite clear. Now, the sequence of events is, the apparent sequence of events is laid out in point B, verses 1, 2, 3, and 4. Apparently, he was released from confinement in Jerusalem by Nebuzaradan, and he was told, you're free to go throughout the land. And he took advantage of that freedom, and apparently he was rearrested by Babylonian soldiers who didn't know who this guy was. They hadn't heard the orders. They didn't know who he was. So, point one, he's found among the captives of Jerusalem and Judah, now in the process of being carried away to Babylon. And Ramah was the point of departure for Babylon. So here's your map. See, Ramah is just a few miles north of Jerusalem. And so the captives were taken by the Babylonians, and the staging area was Ramah, taken here, organized, however they were organized, and then marched off to Babylon to the north over the top of the Fertile Crescent. So Ramah was the staging area. So point three, the soldiers here are now collecting all the captives, and so they collect Jeremiah as well. He's erroneously collected. But Nebuzaradan's in charge of this, right? He's the guy that Nebuchadnezzar put in charge of the deportation, so he's there to oversee it, and what does he see? What are you doing here, fella? Who brought you here? Well, that guy arrested me. Off with his head, you know. So he's found accidentally among this group being prepared to go off into exile. So Nebuzaradan makes him a second offer on page 430. Now Nebuzaradan is now speaking to him in Ramah. Last week he was speaking to him in Jerusalem, but now it's in Ramah. And he begins his offer to Jeremiah on page 430 in verse 2 by recognizing the source of the disaster. Chapter 40, verse 2. Now the captain of the bodyguard had taken Jeremiah and said to him, the Lord your God promised this calamity against this place. So what's the source of the calamity? Is it Babylon? No, It's God himself. Now, this pagan idol worshiper has some spiritual insight that a lot of his contemporaries didn't have. Let's move on to verse 3. He's recognized that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the author of this disaster, and then he recognizes the reason why. Verse 3. And the Lord has brought it on and done it, just as he promised, because you people sinned against the Lord and did not listen to his voice. Therefore, this thing has happened to you. Now, this is very important, is a recognition that this happened to the Jewish people because of our sins. You see, in that day and age, warfare was considered a battle between gods, a battle between idols. I had my idol, my God, and we went to battle against you and your God. And if I won, my idol, my God, was the strongest. And if you won, well, lucky break, you know. Now, Nebuzaradan doesn't say the gods of Babylon are stronger than the God of Israel. No way. He doesn't say that at all. He recognized that this is not happening because his idols are stronger. He's recognizing that the God of Abraham, Isaac has done this for a specific reason to his own people. That's a bit of a spiritual insight that his contemporaries did not have. You can better believe that most of the soldiers were saying, yeah, the God of Babylon is the strongest. But he wasn't. He knew the truth. So now he lays a choice before Jeremiah in verse 4. But now, behold, I am freeing you today from the chains which are on your hands. If you prefer to come with me to Babylon, come along, and I will look after you. But if you would prefer not to come with me to Babylon, never mind. Look, the whole land is before you. Go wherever it seems good and right for you to go. So he's released. Jeremiah is released. He had some kind of fetters around his wrists. He was chained up just like everyone else to prevent them from escaping. So he's released, and then the choice is stay here or go into exile. The key to this offer is probably parentheses, Roman numeral 2 there, where Nebuzaradan says, I will look after you. This is an extension of personal protection by a very, very important Babylonian official. The point, Jeremiah would be well cared for. He wouldn't be mocked. He wouldn't be enchained. He wouldn't suffer hardship. He wouldn't be thrown into a cistern with mud in the bottom. He wouldn't face starvation like he's faced. He wouldn't be mocked as he has been for 40 years. He'd be well cared for. In fact, he'd probably be pretty respected in Babylon. But he gives him the choice. You don't have to come with me into exile. And then he gives him access to the land, the whole land of Israel. No restrictions. Point 3a at the bottom. Go wherever you want. No restrictions. And at the bottom of the page, point B, again, that important point, Jeremiah is receiving more respect from Gentiles than he does from the majority of his Jewish brothers and sisters. All right, how will Jeremiah respond to this very tempting offer? Sounds good to me, right? Page 431, verse 5 at the top of the page. Verse 5, as Jeremiah was still not going back, he said, go on back then to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon has appointed over the cities of Judah, and stay with him among the people, or else go anywhere that seems right for you to go. So the captain of the bodyguard gave him a ration and a gift and let him go. Question. Where are you talking? Where is this now?
What? Well, it refers to him several times as a bodyguard.
Oh, he's the captain of the bodyguard. Okay. Well, he's the captain of the soldiers that were in charge of this deportation. Why they're called the bodyguard? I don't know. Perhaps he was also over Nebuchadnezzar's bodyguard as well. But he's high up in the military. Okay. He's over the deportation and perhaps over that as well. All right. Now, the translation of the Hebrew is a little bit rough here under point A. Probably the best translation is not point one there, which is the American Standard Version, but it'd be more like the NASB, point B. Yet he would not go back. And the point here is point Roman numeral 2. Jeremiah did not return an answer. That's basically the idea there. Jeremiah is reluctant to answer Nebuzaradan. So he kind of stands there, you know, quietly. And Nebuzaradan then recognizes his hesitation. And point B, Nebuzaradan responds to Jeremiah's reluctance. Point large B, capital B, parentheses large capital B, Nebuzaradan sees the reluctance on the part of Jeremiah. And point C there, Jeremiah's reluctance is probably based on the fact that to say no would probably insult. He was probably afraid to insult Nebuzaradan. You know, couldn't you imagine Nebuzaradan saying, you don't want to go back to magnificent Babylon? Back to my country? Under my protection? Under magnificent King Nebuchadnezzar? You want to stay here? In this ruin? You know, he could be insulted. That's why Jeremiah is probably concerned. But Nebuzaradan is not insulted by this. He sees that Jeremiah wishes to remain, and he's very happy to allow him to do so. Now, point capital D, Roman numeral bracket 2 there. Do you see that? This is a key point. He, Jeremiah, is not a traitor, and he chooses poverty in the land over against wealth in Babylon. Now, I think this was really quite a temptation to Jeremiah. And I think this is a temptation because he had gone through 40 years of abuse. 40 years of people saying, oh, shut up. 40 years of being harassed, thrown in jail, kicked out of the temple, his life threatened on a couple of occasions. We've gone through all this. People wanting to starve him in jail. You know, he's gone through all kinds of abuse for predicting the fall of Jerusalem, for standing up for the Lord. I could see him taking this attitude. Aha, this is my vindication. Look at this. 40 years of garbage, and now I'm going to be a big guy. Now I'm going to live in Babylon and have nice robes and good food, and I could lord it over the captives. You know, I'll be a big cheese, a big macher in Babylon. Boy, that'd be a temptation, wouldn't it? 40 years, now I'm getting vindicated. But he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. He'd rather stay with his people in the land. He's no traitor. He's no opportunist to grab this offer of wealth. Okay, we move on to the last point on the bottom of verse 431, chapter 4, page 431. He's told to go to Gedaliah and stay with him. Point A, Gedaliah is again identified, the son of Ahikam. And if you turn the page, you see that chart we've come across before. Ahikam was the son of Shaphan, the grandson of Shaphan. Or I should say Gedaliah is the grandson of Shaphan. Remember that spiritual man who had three believing sons, Ahikam, Gemariah, and Elasa, and two believing grandsons. And Gedaliah is one of those believing grandsons. He's a good man. He supported Jeremiah. He was taken into captivity in the second deportation 18 years ago. He has now risen to a place of trust and authority in the Babylonian government. Not only did Daniel rise up, many Jewish people rose up. We were prospering in Babylon. So here, he's brought back to the land, a Jewish man, to rule the Jewish country. So he must have been well respected by Nebuchadnezzar and trusted. So he's under the, Jeremiah is now under the authority of Gedaliah. And point five closes the verse with Nebuzaradan's provisions for Jeremiah. Very generous provisions. He gives him food and he gives him financial assistance. So again, this exhibition of care and concern and respect for Jeremiah. So where does Jeremiah choose to settle down? Point four in your outline, verse six. Then Jeremiah went to Mizpah to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, and stayed with him among the people who were left in the land. So here on your map is Mitzpah. Mitzpah is just to the north of Ramah, just off the main road, a little bit to the west. So that's where Gedaliah is staying. Now on your outline, we come to point B, and now we get a little look at the leadership of Gedaliah and the course of his governorship. It didn't last too long, but we get a little peek at it here. First of all, his number one priority is to deal with the Jewish military units that are still in the land. Now, when we talk about military units here, we're talking about Jewish military units, not Babylonian military units. So we come to verse 7, and we come to the occasion. Here's a Gedaliah's first priority. Verse 7. Now all the commanders of the forces that were in the field, they and their men, heard that the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, over the land, and that he had put him in charge of the men, women, and children, those of the poorest of the land who had not been exiled to Babylon. So point A1, the captains of the forces that were in the field. These are, parentheses B there, guerrilla bands. These are small bands of soldiers that were maneuvering in the Judean hills outside the cities. And being mobile like this, being mobile guerrilla units, they were not captured. They probably harassed the Babylonian troops around their flanks and probably did raids on the camp, things like that. Whatever they could do to harass the Babylonian army while they were coming into the land. So they're still free and moving around. Now they hear that Gedaliah is the governor, point two. On page 433.3, the authority of Gedaliah is laid out, the men, women, children, the poorest of the land that he is over. So they get the news, and in verse 8, they come to him at Mitzpah, verse 8. So they came to Gedaliah at Mitzpah, along with Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, and Yochanan, and Yonatan, the sons of Kareah, and Sariah, the son of Tanhumet, and then sons of Ephi, the Netophatite, and Yenazniah, and the son of the Makathite, both they and their men. Now in verse 8, we see that there were at least six guerrilla bands operating in the Judean hills at that time, and their leadership is brought out here. Now the two most important guys to note are number one and number two, Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, and Yochanan, the son of Kareah. They will become very prominent in the next few minutes. So those are the guys that are important. But we see there's six bands of guerrilla forces. Now they talk with Gedaliah, and he makes an offer to them in verse 9. So they meet with him. Then Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, swore to them and to their men, saying, "Do not be afraid of serving the Chaldeans. Stay in the land and serve the king of Babylon, that it may go well with you." So point A, the offer here is an offer of clemency, if they will submit to his authority and the authority of the Babylonians. So this is an offer of mercy. They will not be hunted down. They will not be captured. They will not be executed. They will not be sent to Babylon. All they have to do is submit to Gedaliah's authority, and it will go well with them. So this is very consistent with Nebuchadnezzar's position, right? He would back off as soon as you said, "I'm on your side, buddy. I'll submit." He'd say, "Great, fine, prosper." He wasn't interested in beating people into the ground. If you didn't submit, eventually he'd get harder and harder and harder until he squished you like a cockroach, right? But as soon as you submitted, he would ease up. So that's what he offers them. Submit and it'll go well. Now he explains his role in the first part of verse 10, Gedaliah's role as governor. First part of verse 10. "Now as for me, behold, I'm going to stay at Mitzpah to stand for you before the Chaldeans who come to us. So he's going to dwell at Mitzpah. What he's going to do is establish an administrative city. You know, Jerusalem's been devastated. All the houses burned. The city is leveled. The temple is leveled. So he needs a new administrative center, and that's going to be Mitzpah. That's going to be the Babylonians' headquarters. And he says, bottom of the page, last sentence, he will stand before the Chaldeans. In other words, he's going to represent the Jewish people to the Babylonians. So we have a Jewish man representing Jewish people to the Babylonian overlords. So you're in a good position when you got a guy on your side representing you. And the Babylonians paying attention to him and respecting him. So really, this is pretty advantageous. You know, Nebuchadnezzar did not put a Babylonian over the territory. You know, the Romans did that. The Romans put Roman governors over the Jewish people, right? Did the Roman governors give a whip about the Jewish people in the first century? Pilate, he would cause nothing but trouble, and he wasn't the worst one. So the Romans didn't trust the leadership, the governorship of Israel into Jewish hands. Even Herod was an Idumean. He wasn't Jewish. But Nebuchadnezzar is more merciful than that. Okay, page 434, point C at the top, last part of verse 10, we see that everything will return to normal if this occurs. Verse 10, he says, "But as for you, gather in wine and summer fruit and oil and put them in your storage vessels and live in your cities that you have taken over." So he tells them to return to working the land, to being farmers and enjoying the produce of the land. Wine, fruit, oil. And notice he says, B, put them in vessels. This means there's an excess. The population of the land has been so decimated. Village dwellers, when the Babylonians come, would flee to the fortified cities. And all the fortified cities went down in flames. So the population was decimated. And so there was an excess of produce in the land. So they could have plenty to store up for the upcoming winter. And then he says, point two, dwell in the cities which you have taken. The idea means to capture, the cities you have captured. So point 2B, the military units had retained control of smaller cities, little villages. The Chaldeans didn't bother with. The Babylonians went after the major fortified cities, Azekah, Lachish, Jerusalem, remember that? They went after the big fortified cities where the population had fled to, where the majority of the military units were. And so there were smaller, tiny villages that were still intact. So these men could live there and live off the farms of those villages. So not only are these military bands told to return to normal and live in the villages, but refugees hear about the situation. And they return as well. And we pick this up in verse 11. Well, question.
When the subjects, they were not slaves or prisoners, when they were living in their own village, were they living according to the laws of the Babylonians, or were they following their own laws? I mean,
well, as it turns out, this only lasts for 2 months. So it's really kind of a moot question. They lived under the leadership of Gedaliah, but what exactly the details were, we don't know. So this situation will only last a short time, as we'll see. Okay, so where did the refugees come from? It's the first part of verse 11. Likewise, all the Jews who were in Moab and among the sons of Ammon and in Edom and who were in all the other countries. So here on our map, we see Israel. And Edom is modern southern Jordan today. That's the approximate location of Edom. To the north is Moab, modern central Jordan today. And to the north of them is Ammon, modern northern Jordan today. And these three nations have not yet been conquered by Babylon. Babylon hasn't come east. Babylon has come down the coast here and destroyed Israel. And remember, that's where Zedekiah was trying to flee to. Zedekiah was trying to get to Ammon, because he would find safety there. and he was captured there by Jericho. So the refugees have fled, just like refugees do today. They fled to the east into these neighboring countries. And it says other countries, so perhaps Egypt as well, and maybe, well, who knows where else. But anyway, these are the three major countries. So second part of verse 11, the occasion, verse 11b. They heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant in Judah, and that he had appointed over them Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan. So they get the news that we have a Jewish governor over the Jewish people. And so when they hear that Nebuchadnezzar has done that, they figure it's safe to return. Things have calmed down, and we have somebody on our side representing us. Page 435. So they return in the first part of verse 12. Then all the Jews returned from all the places to which they had been driven away, and they came to the land of Judah to Gedaliah at Mizpah. So up on our map, we just see them returning from wherever they have been hiding out in exile. So they return to Israel. And again, to a Jewish governor, to the new administrative center. And then life returns to normal, second part of verse 12. And they gathered in wine and summer fruit in great abundance. So again, the huge decrease in population has left an abundance of wine and oil, etc., for these refugees. And so they have plenty to store away and to make it through the upcoming winter. They get the summer fruit. It's now harvest time. And so Israel is getting back to day-to-day conditions, normal conditions, but it only lasts 2 months. It was all too short, and then Gedaliah is murdered. And that's the point of C, point C in the middle of the page. The murder of Gedaliah begins with a warning. And that warning is verse 13. Now Yochanan, the son of Kareah, and all the commanders of the forces that were in the field came to Gedaliah at Mizpah. So point one, capital A there. Yochanan is singled out. He's probably the spokesman, the recognized general, the leader over these guerrilla forces. So he comes, and then the captains of the forces that were in the field. These will be four more officers of the guerrilla band. So five of the six officers come to Gedaliah at Mizpah. Now, why did they come? Chapter 40, verse 14. And they said to him, "Are you well aware that Baalis, the king of the sons of Ammon, has sent Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, to take your life?" Ishmael's missing from the group, right? Ishmael's not there. This is leader number six. So here on the map, here, the king of Ammon, this Gentile king, has hired this Jewish man, this Jewish military leader, to assassinate Gedaliah, the Jewish governor. Now, why? Point C there. Oh, there could be many reasons, but there are at least a couple of them put down there to consider. One, he just wanted to harass the Babylonians. He just wanted to cause trouble. You know, Zedekiah had tried to flee to him, so he was no friend of Babylon. And he hadn't been conquered yet, so he thought he could harass Babylon. Or secondly, perhaps he was greedy. This might have been an attempt to annex territory, to do away with the Chaldean-appointed governor and then perhaps send his own forces in there. We don't know. Anyway, those are two possible reasons. How does Gedaliah respond to this warning? And in an amazing way, we read verse 14, second part of the verse. But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, did not believe them. Why? I'm sure you're asking that question. Why? Question, yes. Oh, when the temple was destroyed in AD 70, the Jewish believers left Jerusalem, crossed over the Jordan River, and then went up to Pella. And Pella is right in this area here. Okay? But this is in 70 AD. That's later on, yeah. Okay. Why in the world would he reject this counsel from five military leaders? Well, we don't know. It doesn't state there. One of the students in the morning class brought out the observation that there's no comments here about him consulting Jeremiah. Jeremiah is living with him there in Mitzpah. Does he go to the prophet, try to get a verification of this accusation? Does he go to prayer? No statement that he goes to prayer, no statement that he goes to Jeremiah. He apparently does not consult the Lord in any way. And this can be a godly person's mistake. Every one of us can do this, right? Okay, but apparently he's trusting. He may be so trusting that he's naive. And that's another thing. We need to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves, right? We need to trust, but we can't be naive. And we can't take matters into our own hands, either actively or passively. So I don't know what's going on with Gedaliah here. Doesn't say, but he does not believe them. Okay, page 436. Yochanan then gets off to the side with him and makes him a little private deal here. Such a deal. Okay, verse 15. Then Yochanan, the son of Kareah, spoke secretly to Gedaliah in Mizpah, saying, "Let me go and kill Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, and not a man will know. Why should he take your life so that you would be scattered and the remnant of Judah would perish?" Okay, so here's the deal I'm offering you for free. Such a deal. I'll take his life. You'll be safe. Okay? Now why? Point C. Why should he be able to kill the governor that the Babylonians have set up? You're the Babylonian leader. I recognize your position of authority. This is not a wise thing for him to do. What would happen? Point two, he fears a Babylonian reprisal. If the Babylonians hear that a Jewish man has risen up and killed the governor, what's Nebuchadnezzar going to do? He's going to go, again. And he's going to, this is a fourth time they rebelled against me. He's going to come in and he's going to do it really bad to us. Okay, so he has grounds for his concern, doesn't he? We've rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar three times and every time it got worse. So he doesn't want it to happen again. So he has a history to go by. What does Gedaliah do? Verse 16. But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, said to Yochanan, the son of Kareah, "Do not do this thing, for you are telling a lie about Ishmael." Wow. So he says, right out, "You're lying about this guy." Again, I don't know why he was so trusting of Ishmael, but he was. Okay. Well, the story moves on in chapter 41 when we get to the murder itself. Let me go about five more minutes and then we'll take our break because we've got going a little late. And we'll break in about five more minutes. So let's get into chapter 41 for a minute or two. So the story continues in verse 1. Now it came about that in the seventh month that Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, the son of Elishama of the royal family, and one of the chief officers of the king, along with 10 men, came to Mitzpah to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, while they were eating bread together there in Mitzpah. So there's a lot in this verse. It'll take us at least 5 minutes to get through this verse. So we have the date. It's the 7 months. It's Tishrei. Tishrei falls around October. So now it's 2 months after Jerusalem has fallen, right? 2 months of normalcy. 2 months of getting back into the land and living there. Now, point D at the bottom of the page, this is the basis for the fast of Gedaliah. Jewish community observes this fast even today. It is a non-biblical fast because it's not commanded. It is a traditional fast, but it is mentioned in Zechariah 7 and Zechariah 8. So this is the, you see now the origin of the reason for this fast. Page 437. And the murderer is described here. Ishmael, the son of Netaniah. Point B, here's an important point. The grandson of Elishama. He's probably a descendant of Elishama. Point B, too, who is Elishama? He was a son of David, King David. So he is of the royal seed. All right, let's take a look at David's family up on the overhead here. And the morning class wanted this chart, so you will get this chart next week. Right? Okay. Here's David's family. He was quite a guy. He had quite a family. And a whole bunch of wives, right? For me, one's enough. Now here's his wives. His primary wives are Michal. She bore him no children, daughter of Saul. Ahinoam, she bore him Amnon. Abigail, wife of Nabal, she bore him Kileab. Maacah bore him Absalom. He's the guy that rebelled, right? Haggith bore him Adonijah. Abital bore him Shephatiah. Eglah bore him Ithream. And now we come to Bathsheba. Bathsheba, she's the most prominent wife here. And she bears him a number of children. We follow her genealogy down, and we come to two very important guys, Solomon and Nathan, right? Also, Shemaiah and Shobab, but Nathan and Solomon are the key ones. Now, the Davidic covenant and the line of the Messiah originally came through Solomon. Now, the Davidic covenant was made unconditionally with David. Then David passed it on to Solomon with the condition that Solomon and his sons are obedient. Now, were Solomon and his sons obedient? Uh-uh. Not at all. In fact, the worst one was Jeconiah, Coniah. Remember him? He was so bad, he received the Jeconiah curse, right? No man from Jeconiah's seed will prosper sitting on the line of David. So line of David, the messianic line, stopped at Jeconiah at that point, and it was transferred over to Nathan. And this is very important in the genealogy of the Messiah. Why? Because Matthew covers Joseph's genealogy, which goes through Solomon, which goes through the cursed line of Solomon, right? Matthew's point in his genealogy is Joseph is no way Yeshua's father. Joseph comes from this cursed line. God is Jesus' father. That's the point of Matthew's genealogy. He is not trying to prove that Jesus in any way is related to Joseph, just the opposite. And he solves the Jeconiah curse problem with the virgin birth. Now, we still need a link to David, and that is through Mary's genealogy through Nathan. Mary's genealogy goes through Nathan, back to Bathsheba and David, to the Davidic covenant. So here is Yeshua's royal genealogy is here. Through Nathan. So that's very important. Two very important fellows to be aware of. And both came from Bathsheba. Now, there's David's primary wives, but he had other wives. Look at that. I don't know how many other. But we follow their genealogy down, and we come to a whole bunch of other sons, one of which is Elishama. Look at that. There's another guy named Elishama, but apparently he's not the same one we're talking about. It could be him. We don't know. We come down here to Elishama, and who came from Elishama but Ishmael? There he is. So he's part of the royal seed, okay, in that way. By the way, David also had concubines, 10 concubines. These are secondary wives. He was a busy guy, yeah. And he had other sons by them, 1 Chronicles 3:9. We don't he was a busy guy. He had to have a king's income to support all that, right? Not to worry, my dear. I don't make enough.
Can you imagine what their dinner table
was? All right. So the point here is that Ishmael comes from the royal line. He's a descendant of David through Elishama. Ishmael rebels against Gedaliah, probably. I am surmising here. But he is probably resentful of Gedaliah. Gedaliah was not of the royal house. He wasn't of David's line. How dare that commoner be king over Israel, be governor over Israel? I am of the king's line. Why didn't Nebuchadnezzar appoint me to be governor? And the king of Ammon likes that, you know, and manipulates him and says, hey, go kill him. Go kill him. And he probably sweetened the pot for some reason with Ishmael as well. So that is probably why Ishmael did this thing. He's got 10 men under him, a little band of soldiers. They come to Gedaliah at Mitzvah, and point 3a, they're eating bread together. So again, Gedaliah must have trusted it implicitly, because eating together in that culture was a sign of fellowship and friendship, total acceptance. It wasn't a casual thing. He was saying, I trust you. I will protect you. You are my friend. And so he's offering any kind of an olive branch. I mean, if you could offer an olive branch of friendship to anybody, that's what he's doing. But he doesn't seem to understand that Ishmael has a different agenda. And then point B, put in any kind of a adjective you like here. He now commits a horrible violation of the Eastern rules of hospitality. I don't know what other adjectives you could put in there. Despicable violation, horrible violation. What are some other good adjectives? You think them up. In other words, you don't kill your host at an Oriental meal. You don't kill your host at this kind of a meal. He is going to desecrate the concept of hospitality here. Okay. With that cheery ending, let's go take our break and have some nosh and be kind to each other as you eat. Nobody, no sword fights out there. So listen for the break, okay? Go ahead, Nick. Alrighty. So we're at the banquet. We're at the banquet, Gedaliah's banquet, probably in the evening at Mitzpah. Jeremiah is not present. You'll see that God protects him again. Jeremiah is not there. Point B on page 347, verse 2. We come to the killing of Gedaliah, the assassination of Gedaliah, verse 2. Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, and the 10 men who were with him arose and struck down Gedaliah, the son of Achikam, the son of Shaphan, with the sword, and put to death the one whom the king of Babylon had appointed over the land. So there, his desecration of hospitality and his rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar. And he goes on. Killing Gedaliah is not the end of it. Verse 3. Ishmael also struck down all the Jews who were with him, that is, with Gedaliah at Mitzpah, and the Chaldeans who were found there, the men of war. So he kills the Jews that were with him. These are Gedaliah's his advisors, something like that, his other government officials. Jeremiah is not present, so we see God protecting Jeremiah again. And then Gedaliah's bodyguard. He's got a Chaldean bodyguard there, a Babylonian bodyguard, and they are killed as well. It must have been quite a dinner, yeah. So is our kitchen clean? There's no blood on the floor of our kitchen? All right. Okay. You guys got along. All right. Now that doesn't end it. As we turn to page 438, the atrocities continued. Ishmael and his men commit more atrocities. Verse 4, chapter 41, verse 4. Now it happened on the next day after the killing of Gedaliah, when no one knew about it. So this is the next day. I suspect that the banquet was in the evening, that the murders occurred in the evening. Nobody escaped the banquet hall. Nobody in Mitzvah knew about it. It's the morning now. And they had disposed of the bodies, and you'll find out where in just a moment. So it's the next morning. Nobody knows what's happened. Verse 5. It happened the next day that 80 men came from Shechem, from Shiloh, from Samaria, with their beards shaved off and their clothes torn and their bodies gashed, having grain offerings and incense in their hands to bring to the house of the Lord. So we have 80 men heading toward Jerusalem with offerings. Now the cities mentioned, point 2, are all former centers of idolatry when the northern kingdom was in existence, Shechem, Shiloh, and Samaria. And so these were, in parentheses perhaps, pious Jews that are descendants of the remnants left in the northern kingdom, and that should be the northern kingdom or the Assyrian captivity. That word of is probably a misprint. It probably is. These are pious Jews left from the northern or Assyrian captivity. That occurred in 722. The Assyrians came in, wiped out the northern kingdom, transported the majority of Jewish people out of the land, and brought pagan people into the northern kingdom to replace them, and left just a remnant of Jewish people. And these Jewish people then intermarried with the pagans that they brought in. And we'll see that in just a moment. So these are the grandchildren or great-grandchildren of the descendants left in the land in 722 BC. Now these men, point four, are in mourning. Shaved beards, torn clothes are signs of mourning. Today at a Jewish funeral, you'll wear a little torn ribbon, a little black torn ribbon, symbolizing the torn clothes, symbolizing mourning. You'll put it on. We don't actually tear our clothes today, but we do have this symbol. Notice point C. They had cut themselves. Now that is not an acceptable sign of mourning. That is a violation of the law of Moses. The other two are fine. But in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, we see very clearly that God commanded that the Jewish people do not slash themselves as a sign of mourning. This was a pagan practice. So where did these grandchildren, Jewish grandchildren of Jewish the Jewish remnant, get this practice? Well, again, 2 Kings 17, starting in verse 24. We'll quickly look at that background. Now, this is 722 BC, about 150 years earlier. The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Kutath and from Ava and from Hamat and Sepharvaim and settled them in the cities of Samaria in place of the sons of Israel. So they possessed Samaria and lived in its cities. So Assyria was the dominant empire at that time, and the king of Assyria brings in these pagan peoples to repopulate the northern kingdom. Now let's drop all the way down to verse 41, 2 Kings 17:41. You can read the whole story for yourself, but here's the summary. So while these nations, this is Kuthath and Babylon and Ava, etc. So while these nations feared the Lord, they also served their idols, their children likewise, and their grandchildren, as their fathers did, and so they do to this day. So as so often happens, there was syncretism that occurred. They accepted the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they just added him into their idols, just another idol to worship, another God to worship. And so the Jewish remnant picked this up as well. Now we see that they picked this up in Ezra 9, 1 and 2, another cross-reference to write down. When Ezra comes back into the land after the Babylonian captivity, this is what he experiences. Now, when these things had been completed, the princes approached me, saying, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands, according to their abominations, those of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Egyptians and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons, and so that the holy race has intermingled with the peoples of the lands. Indeed, the hands of the princes and the rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness." So you see the Jewish people living in Samaria intermingled, intermarried with these pagan people, and syncretism occurred. They added their idols to the worship of the Lord. And so that's why these men, in Jeremiah's day, 150 years after this had occurred, we see the syncretization had already occurred. These men are obeying the law of Moses and pagan practices. Okay? It's a both-and situation right now. All righty. So what are they doing on page 439? They're carrying offerings to the temple. Or as your notes say, what was left of it is just rubble on the ground. And they are celebrating the festivals of the seventh month. The festivals that fall in the seventh month are trumpets, Rosh Hashanah, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles. And they're bringing offerings stipulated in the Law of Moses for that celebration. So they're doing what we still do today. They are going down to the ruins of the temple and trying to worship the Lord in the best way they know how. And here's an example of how we do this today. up on the screen. Here's a bar mitzvah, but where is this bar mitzvah being held? The Western Wall, right? At the Western Wall. Here is the Feast of Trumpets. This guy's probably doing a better job than me. But where is he blowing his shofar? At the Western Wall, the remnants of the temple. We're still doing the same thing today. So these men are coming with their half-obedient, half-pagan practices. So as we come to verse 6, we see that Ishmael deceives them. Verse 6. Chapter 41, verse 6. Then Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, went out from Mizpah to meet them, weeping as he went. And it came about as he met them that he said to them, come to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam. So this guy gets the very first Oscar, right? He's just an actor pretending to be in mourning. So he invites them into Mizpah, verse 7, the one invitation they never should have accepted. Yet it turned out that as they came back inside the city, Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, and the men who were with him slaughtered them and cast them into the cistern.
My gosh, that must have been a big cistern.
Well, you're with me. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Bonnie is always one step ahead of me. She is always one step ahead of me, isn't she? All right. Now, 70 men are now tossed into this cistern. Now, I said 70, and you'll see why in the next verse. Now, this word means either a pit or a cistern. Word can mean either. And cisterns were just water storage pits. Small ones were carved out of the rock underneath your home. If you had a cutting-edge quality home in those days, you had a cistern. You didn't have any running water, but you had a cistern in your floor. And cities had cisterns, large water pits carved in them for water storage. Some were very huge. For example, here's Mizpah. I missed the map. Here's the main road going by Mizpah. These guys are going down the main road here. They go right by the city, and they get invited into the city. That's the lay of the land here. But now here's an idea of a large cistern. This is the large cistern at Masada. And it rains at Masada, and every drop is guided through channels into cisterns. And they were basically self-sufficient up at Masada. They could grow crops up there. But this is one big, huge cistern, isn't it? Now, this picture is taken at the top of the stairway. And we're going to now go down the stairway, and we're going to stand right where this fella is, and we're going to turn our camera 180 degrees. And there's the stairway that was carved into the cistern. Now, the railing, of course, is modern. But, ladies, if you had to get your water, that's the stairs you had to go down. Now, if the cistern was full of water, you only had to descend one or two steps, right? But as the cistern lost water, you had to go further and further down the stairway before you got to the water level. So you can see it's cut out of the rock of Masada and then plastered. The plaster made the cistern watertight. And as you can see, this cistern is covered. Most cisterns were covered because water lasts very well when it's covered and in the dark. You leave water out in the sunlight and algae gets on it, right? Ugh. But if you cover water, it lasts a long time. Now, it's not like bottled water that we get from Arrowhead Springs. You know, who knows what they drank, but their standards were not the same as our standards, and their stomachs were probably a lot stronger than ours. Okay, but there's where the people in Masada got their water. And so some of the cisterns were very, very large. Now, this cistern at Mizpah was probably damaged. It probably was empty, maybe was leaky, but it was large enough for 70 men here, and probably, maybe 20 previous bodies, because let's see. There were ten men with Ishmael. So let's say there were maybe 10 men with Gedaliah, and then there were the Babylonian guards. So we got maybe 20 men killed and tossed into the cistern. Now we got 70 more. We got 90 to 100 bodies tossed into that thing. Okay. All right. Now I said 70 men were killed. Why did I say 70 men? Well, verse 8 tells us that 10 men saved themselves. Verse 8. But 10 men who were found among them said to Ishmael, "Do not put us to death, for we have stores of wheat, barley, oil, and honey hidden in the field." So he refrained and did not put them to death along with their companions. So Ishmael probably saves their life because of greed. He probably wants these valuable products of the land. And I suspect that if he was led to one of these stores of wheat, barley, or oil, he would probably take them and then slit the throat of the owner and toss him into the pit. Yeah. So I think it was just a temporary thing. But these guys are left alive. And now the burial pit is described in verse 9. You asked about it, Bonnie. Here it comes. Verse 9. "Now, as for the cistern where Ishmael had cast all the corpses of the men whom he had struck down because of Gedaliah, it was the one that King Asa had made on account of Baasha, the king of Israel. Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, filled it with the slain." So it appears that the bodies of Gedaliah and the men who were with him, the Babylonians and Gedaliah's counselors, were tossed into that pit on the night before. So as I was saying, we've got maybe 90, maybe 100 corpses in that pit. And that's probably the reason why it's described as the one that King Asa made, because he cut this pit, it says, during the wars he had in order to allow Mizpah to withstand a siege. Mizpah was his northernmost city. And so he wanted it to withstand a siege, so he probably cut a pretty good-sized cistern. And that's probably why it's mentioned here. So it's a very large cistern that could take, say, 100 corpses.
Did archaeologists ever find it?
I don't know if it's ever been located. Another one has been located, which we'll see in just a minute. We'll take a look at another one. Now, verse 10. The atrocities continue in verse 10. "Then Ishmael took captive all the remnant of the people who were in Mizpah, the king's daughters and all the people who were left in Mizpah, whom Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, had put under the charge of Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam. Thus Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, took them captive and proceeded to cross over to the sons of Ammon." So now he captures everybody left in Mizpah, and he wants to head for Ammon. And on our map here, he wants to head for that northernmost country. I suspect he wants to probably sell these people to the Ammonites as slave and make a quick buck off of them.
How many are we talking about?
We don't know. We don't know. It doesn't say here. I would say it's a good number of people, and I suspect that Ishmael said, "How are we going to feed all these people?" And maybe one of the men with the stores of wheat, barley, and all that said, "Hey, I've got something hidden where do they go here? I've got something." Well, we'll see where they go. And this is probably the reason why they don't directly go to Ammon. We'll see that in just a minute. Gibeon. They go to Gibeon. He probably says, "You know, I've got some supplies at Gibeon." So this is probably why Ishmael goes to Gibeon first and not directly to Ammon. All right, so that decision leads to the rescue of the remnant. Verse 11. "But Yochanan, the son of Kareah," remember him? Yochanan, the son of Kareah, "and all the commanders of the forces that were with him," that's the other five guys, "heard of all the evil that Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, had done." So the timing of this banquet was very clever. Gedaliah's defender, Yochanan, is not there. Remember, Yochanan wanted to do in Ishmael. So he's not around when this banquet occurs. So he left the door open to Ishmael. Why he wasn't around, we don't know. Why Jeremiah was there, we don't know. But anyway, the murder occurred. We know Jeremiah wasn't there because God was protecting him, right? God promised him, "You won't die violently." So God had him out of Mizpah for some reason. Verse 12. "So they took all the men and went to fight with Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, and they found him at the great pool that is in Gibeon." Okay, they catch him at the great waters of Gibeon. Now, where is Gibeon? Here's our map, Jerusalem and Mizpah. Gibeon is a little south and a little east of Mizpah, very close. So they go to Gibeon. I'm going to submit to you to get supplies for this large group of people that they have captured. And then they're going to head from Gibeon across the Jordan Valley to the Ammonites. Okay, that's his plan. He never gets to execute his plan. Now, we notice on the bottom of the page, point B, he finds him at the pool of Gibeon. Now, the pool of Gibeon is another very large cistern. Here's the pool of Gibeon. Archaeologists have uncovered it. And you can see the stairway going down here to the bottom of the pool. And, of course, again, ladies, tell your daughter to go get water, or tell your young son to go get water. It was a bit precarious. Again, if the water level was high, you'd only go down those stairs. But if the water level was lower, you had to go further down. So I would throw a bucket down. Yeah, maybe. Now, this thing, again, was probably covered. Today it's uncovered, but when it was in use, it was probably covered to keep the water fresh. So they probably went there to get supplies and to get water so they could make the trek to Ammon safely, get these people over there without them starving or being endangered by a lack of food. So what happens when they catch up with Ishmael? Verse 13 and 14. Now what came about, as soon as all the people who were with Ishmael saw Yochanan, the son of Kareah, and the commanders of the forces that were with him, and they were glad. You can better believe they were glad. Hey, look at this! The cavalry's coming! Okay? So all the people whom Ishmael had taken captive from Mizpah turned around and came back and went to Yochanan, the son of Kareah. So there's only 10 men guarding them, 10 armed men guarding this whole gaggle of people. So they get their courage up and they take off. They take off. Verse 15. But Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, escaped from Yochanan with 8 men and went to the sons of Ammon. So there's a battle engaged, and 2 men of Ishmael are lost in that battle. And so he gets away to Ammon. He gets away to his supporter. And so the people of Mizpah have been saved. But they do not return to Mizpah. They moved to a place called Gerut Chimham, at point 2 there. I want you to name your next child that. Gerut Chimham, okay? And verse 16. Then Yochanan, the son of Kareah, and all the commanders of the forces that were with him, took from Mizpah all the remnant of the people whom he had recovered from Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, after he had struck down Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, that is, the men who were soldiers, the women, the children, the eunuchs, whom he had brought back from Gibeon. So again, the royal family, everybody at who were living in Mizpah, they gathered together and they actually moved south. They do not go back to Mizpah, they move south. They move to a temporary place abode in verse 17. Verse 17. And they went and stayed in Gerut Chimham, which is beside Bethlehem, in order to proceed unto Egypt. Okay, now we don't know what this word Gerut Chimham means, or where it's precisely where it's located. Some commentators think that it probably means the dwelling place of Chimham. In 2 Samuel 19, we don't know if it was an inn. We don't know if it was a man's house. We don't know if it was a caravanserai. A caravanserai is a stopping place for caravans, for camel caravans, moving toward perhaps to Jerusalem. A motel, you know, an ancient motel. Probably just a place for an overnight stay. But we do know it was in the region of Bethlehem. Now let's look at our map again. Here's Mizpah and Gibeon and Jerusalem. Now where's Bethlehem? Bethlehem is 5 miles south of Jerusalem. So these guys have continued south on the main road to the vicinity of Bethlehem. Now why do they go there? Well, they want to go to Egypt. What they want to do is take the Elah Valley right here. You see this water course? This is the Elah Valley. They want to take that route down to the coast. At the coast, they would intersect the Via Maris, and they would follow the Via Maris to Egypt. So that's their plan. That's why they went to Bethlehem. They want to head to the coast as soon as possible, because they want to get to Egypt as soon as possible. So they know where they're going. Now, why do they want to get to Egypt? Verse 18. They wanted to proceed to Egypt because of the Chaldeans, for they were afraid of them, since Ishmael, the son of Netaniah, had struck down Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, whom the king of Babylon had appointed over the land. So again, they're afraid of a reprisal by the Babylonians. All right, this moves us into chapter 42. The story continues. They come to Jeremiah in verse 1. Chapter 42, verse 1. Now in the region of Bethlehem, they stop for a while there. They come to Jeremiah. Then all the commanders of the forces, Yochanan, the son of Kareah, that's a hard one, I'm guessing at that one, the son of Hoshea, and all the people, both small and great, approached. So we have the two commanders, probably, of the forces, Yochanan and that guy. He's probably second in command. They lead the people to seek out Jeremiah, verse 2. And they said to Jeremiah the prophet, "Please let our petition come before you, and pray for us to the Lord your God, that is, for all this remnant, because we are left but a few out of many, as your own eyes now see us." So they say, "Pray unto the Lord your God." So he asked them to pray for them. And the reason why they want Jeremiah to pray to the Lord is in verse 3. Here's the reason why. "Pray that the Lord your God may save us." "That the Lord your God may tell us the way in which we should walk and the thing that we should do." Now, the purpose for the supplication appears to be a desire for guidance. However, we will see next week very clearly that this is not a desire for guidance. It's simply a desire for confirmation. They've already decided what they want to do. But it is crystal clear to them that Jeremiah is a true prophet. All his prophecies have come true now, so they recognize his prophetic office, and so they go to him. They're making an assumption. They're assuming that he will support their plan to go to Egypt. It seems crystal clear to them. But as we turn to page 445, we turn to Jeremiah's response. Verse 4. "Then Jeremiah the prophet said to them, 'I have heard you. Behold, I am going to pray to the Lord your God in accordance with your words. And it will come about that the whole message which the Lord will answer you, I will tell you. I will not keep back a word from you.'" Now, I sense a little bit of skepticism in Jeremiah's voice, because he's been enduring insult and rejection for 40 years. But he does agree to pray. So if someone asks you to pray for them, do it. Never hesitate. Never hesitate. They may be the most ungodly person in your workplace, but pray for them. They ask you, you pray for them, okay? But he adds a caveat here. "I'm going to tell you everything, every detail, okay? No more, no less." What do the people promise? What do the people respond? Verse 5. Then they said to Jeremiah, "May the Lord be a true and faithful witness against us if we do not act in accordance with the whole message with which the Lord your God will send you to us." So basically, we're going to obey. And they repeat it in verse 6. "Whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, we will listen to the voice of the Lord our God, to whom we are sending you, in order that it may go well with us when we listen to the voice of the Lord our God." Wow. Sounds great, doesn't it? Whether we like it or not, we're going to obey. Azita. Well, they're recognizing his prophetic office. okay, the Lord your God. They know he has a special relationship with God as a prophet. But they also say the Lord our God here at this point. So they're also recognizing that they're God's people as well. Okay. Now, it sounds good, but point three there at the bottom of the page, this promise is false. They've already made up their mind. They're just looking for divine confirmation. Sound familiar? Sound like you and me? You better believe it. Sounds like me anyway. Okay, the answer does come on page 446 in verse 7. Page 446, top of the page, verse 7. Now it came about at the end of 10 days that the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. So why God waited 10 days is up in the air. The rabbis think that God waited the 10 days of the days of awe between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But it doesn't say that in the text. So that might be the reason. It may be that God's just giving them a time to think about their commitment. You know, seeing if they grow impatient. Oh, we're not getting an answer from God, so let's head off to Egypt. You know, that's what we did at Mount Sinai, didn't we? There's Moses up on the mountain for 40 days. Ah, that guy's gone. We better get a golden calf here, you know. So perhaps he was testing their patience. They don't grow impatient. They do wait. Perhaps he's trying to let their panic and fear subside. Perhaps he wants them to evaluate what he's about to say from a more calm spirit, you know, from a more objective spirit. We don't know. So we'll see. We'll ask Jeremiah when we see him in the kingdom. So anyway, God waits for 10 days, and the answer comes in verse 8. Then he called for Yochanan, the son of Kareah, and all the commanders of the forces that were with him, for all the people, both small and great. So he gathers everybody together, and the word comes in verse 9. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, to whom you sent me to present your petition before him." Now here in verse 9, we get a very clear introduction that the message is from God himself. The prophets never confused their own personal thoughts, their own imaginations with the voice of God. They knew the difference. And here Jeremiah very clearly knows that this comes from God. It's not his imagination. Page 447, we come to the first part of the message. It has about three aspects to it. God extends blessings for obedience if. That's a critical word, if, isn't it? Verse 10, if you will indeed stay in this land, then I will build you up and not tear you down. I will plant you and not uproot you, for I shall relent concerning the calamity I have inflicted on you. So God is willing to bless. The judgment time is over. Hey, let's get back to the blessing aspect of walking with me, okay? So I will build you, I will plant you, and point C. Point C, it says, I repent me. Not the best translation of the word. The word repent there, point one, means to grieve. So the idea here is that God has been grieving over this calamity that he sent upon his disobedient and rebellious people. So we see the heart of God here. I'm tired of this, you guys. I'm tired of beating you down. I want you to walk with me so I can bless you. So that's the first aspect. I'm tired of this. I'm grieving over this. Verse 11, next aspect. Do not be afraid of the king of Babylon, whom you are now fearing. Do not be afraid of him, declares the Lord, for I am with you to save you and deliver you from his hand. So now personal protection is promised, not to worry. And in verse 12, God's mercy is brought to the forefront. I will also show you compassion, so that he will have compassion on you and restore you to your own soil. So God is point A, God is going to grant mercy, and this divine mercy is going to point B, result in human mercy. The king of Babylon will have mercy on you. You see, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't as brutal as many kings were. He was quite willing to extend mercy the moment you submitted to him. And so God is behind this. He will show mercy to you. He will let you settle down and live in the land and have a normal life. That's the first part of the message to the remnant. Now on page 448, we come to the second part of the message. Blessings for obedience, but cursings for disobedience. Does this sound like the Mosaic Law? Everybody, shake your head yes. Okay, yes. This is the Mosaic Law. Question. Deuteronomy 28. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. Those are the curses and blessings of the Mosaic Covenant. So he's just following his pattern of the Mosaic Law here. Verse 13. Now it came about, as soon as all the people who were with Ishmael saw Yochanan, the son of Kareah, and the commanders of the forces that were with... Oh, I'm the wrong verse here. Right chapter, chapter 42, verse 13. There we go. But if you are going to say, we will not stay in this land, so as not to listen to the voice of the Lord your God. So verse 13 deals with passive obedience. That's where we all start, right? In our minds. We make a decision in our minds passively not to obey God, right? Okay, that's where sin begins. Verse 14, but it moves to active obedience, saying, no, we will go to the land of Egypt, where we shall not see war or hear the sound of a trumpet or hunger for bread, and we will stay there. So they start passively by deciding not to go, and then they move into active disobedience when they literally go into Egypt to escape hardship. If they do that, what will occur? Verse 15. Then, in that case, listen to the word of the Lord, O remnant of Judah. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, if you really set your mind to enter Egypt and go in to reside there, okay, you guys, if you really want to get active in your disobedience, here's what's going to happen, verse 16, then it will come about that the sword which you are afraid of will overtake you there in the land of Egypt, and the famine about which you are anxious will follow you closely, will follow closely after you there in Egypt, and you will die there. So you're not going to get away from war, and you're not going to get away from hunger, and you will die in Egypt, the death penalty. And that death penalty is emphasized in verse 17, page 449. He makes it crystal clear. And so all the men who set their mind to go to Egypt to reside there will die by the sword, by famine, by pestilence, and they will have no survivors or refugees from the calamity that I'm going to bring on them. So that horrible triad that we've been looking at chapter after chapter after chapter is going to follow you to Egypt. But God knows the people's heart. Jeremiah, unfortunately, has 40 years of experiencing the people's heart, and the heart of the people was full of hypocrisy. And so the warning comes in verse 18 as their hypocrisy is unmasked. Verse 18. For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, as my anger and wrath have been poured out on the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so my wrath will be poured out on you when you enter Egypt, and you will become a curse, an object of horror, an imprecation, and a reproach, and you will see this place no more. Is the message any different? No. Now, what will happen if they go into Egypt? Point C, four things. They're described, their situation in Egypt are described under four words. First, an execration. An execration is a curse, but it's basically, it's more important, it's the punishment for a broken oath. So they're going to be an object of cursing by God. They're going to be punished for breaking their oath. What was their oath? Just a few minutes earlier they had said, we obey, we'll do everything, good or bad, we like it or not, we'll obey. So it'll go good with us. That's their oath. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. So they broke their oath. And so they're going to be punished for it. Secondly, they will become an astonishment. This word means here a horror. In other words, the Egyptians are going to be appalled at you. Look at this group of Jews coming in from Jerusalem. Look what Babylon did to them. Okay? They will be appalled at you. They won't welcome you in with a ticker tape parade. Thirdly, you'll become a curse. To curse somebody means that blessing or prosperity is going to be removed. So you are not going to prosper in Egypt the way you think you will. So you will be a curse. I am not going to allow you to prosper. And finally, you will become a reproach. That means you'll be taunted. You'll be mocked. So if you go into Egypt, I will punish you for breaking your promise to me. The Egyptians will be appalled at you. You will not prosper, and they will mock you. They will mock you. And finally, you will see Judah no more. You will never return here. Oy, 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 oy. Jeremiah has been delivering that kind of message for 40 years, hasn't he? And he delivers it to them. All right, verse 9. We will get through this chapter, and then we'll let you go. This command is reiterated in verse 19. The Lord has spoken to you, O remnant of Judah. Do not go into Egypt. You should clearly understand that today I have testified against you. So it's crystal clear. The message is the same. We should get it. We're a stubborn and stiff-necked people, aren't we? This is what God says of us. And we're still not getting it here. Verse 20. For you have only deceived yourselves. For it is you who sent me to the Lord your God, saying, pray for us to the Lord our God. And whatever the Lord our God says, tell us. And so we will do it. See, there's the promise. But the problem is they're deceiving themselves. Point A1 there. They're not deceiving God. They're deceiving themselves when they promise to do it. But the truth comes out in verse 21. So I have told you today, but you have not obeyed the voice of the Lord your God, even in whatever he has sent me to tell you. So there's the truth. You're hypocrites. You're disobedient. And the chapter closes on, again, a negative note in verse 22 with the final warning, page 451. Therefore, you should now clearly understand. See the responsibility on the remnant? He's not letting them get away with anything. This isn't something done in a corner. This isn't something they shouldn't be able to figure out. Therefore, you should now clearly understand that you will die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence in the place where you wish to go to reside. Well, that brings the chapter to an end, and we move into chapter 43 next week. And we already know what their reaction to the message is going to be, but we will look at it in detail as we move into chapter 43. All right, let me go ahead and close in prayer, and then I'll let you guys go. I'm keeping you a couple minutes long, but we'll be okay. All righty. All right, let's pray. Our Father, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we've seen quite an example of your love for us and our stubborn human nature, haven't you? Haven't you? You've shown this to us. First of all, we've looked at these people as we close this chapter.